Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the March 19th, 2021 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week in the foreground is a smiling President Joe Biden holding out in front of him a very large bill. Looks like a dollar bill, but instead of a one or a five or something, it says a $1,400 bill. His picture is in the middle with shades and a big smile. It says Uncle Joe, and on the bottom it's list lots of dough. In the background is a scowling Republican elephant looking on with disapproval. And the title is Biden's Bonanza, Who Will Benefit from the Democrats' $1.9 trillion COVID Relief Package. And that is our first main story. We'll start right there. The Democrats' mammoth COVID stimulus bill. What happened? The House gave final passage to the $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan this week, handing President Biden a major win 7 weeks into his presidency and unleashing an avalanche of federal spending that will reach well beyond pandemic relief. The package is one of the most consequential and most progressive pieces of legislation in American history, said White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. It cleared the Senate on a 50-49 vote, after some modifications, and then passed the House 220 to 211 with not a single Republican supporting it. Aimed at middle class and poor Americans, the package delivers $1,400 COVID relief payments to every American making under $75,000 or $150,000 for married couples, including their children. Extends $300 weekly unemployment benefits through Labor Day, and provides $350 billion to fill pandemic-related holes in the budgets of state and local governments. It allocates additional billions to schools, testing and vaccination programs, cultural venues, public transit, and ailing industries from airlines to restaurants. Analysts estimate the sweeping bill will cut poverty by a third and child poverty by half. These provisions include an expansion of the child tax credit that for most parents will yield from $3,000 to $3,600 per child a year, whether or not they're employed. The bill also provides a big increase in federal subsidies for middle-class Americans who buy health insurance plans under the Affordable Care Act, making the plans more affordable. The Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center projects that the combined benefits will boost income for the poorest 20% of Americans by 20%. It's the most significant legislation for working people that has been passed in decades, said Senator Bernie Sanders. Republicans hammered the package as excessive and overstuffed with liberal spending priorities with no direct connection to the pandemic. It's a Trojan horse for socialism, said Representative Matt Gaetz of Florida. It's everything Democrats have wanted wrapped up and branded in coronavirus so people are scared into voting for it. What the editorial said. With the end of the pandemic in sight, it's reasonable to wonder whether we still need such a big dose of fiscal medicine, said the Los Angeles Times. But the economic damage individuals and businesses have suffered is deep, and without enough aid and stimulus, it's possible the recession's effects will linger for years, as they did after the 2008 financial crisis. This bill will not only rescue people in trouble, it will pump cash into the economy to help revive restaurants and other local businesses. This massive handout isn't about COVID relief, said the Wall Street Journal. The real objective is to expand and solidify the role of government as the guarantor of every American's income. From tax credits to direct payments to health care subsidies, the bill is larded with generous benefits that will kill people's incentive to work and slow the labor market's recovery as the pandemic eases. The Democrats are intent on building a cradle-to-grave welfare entitlement state. What the columnist said. To quote Biden's reaction to the passage of Obamacare in 2010, this relief bill is a big effing deal, said Eric Levitz in nymag.com. Long derided by progressives as a creature of the establishment, Biden has delivered a profound and far-reaching package that could be the start of a leftward realignment in American policymaking. For working-class and middle-class Americans, the impact will be life-altering. A family of four with one working parent will see $12,460 more in benefits to help them make ends meet. Aid to the poorest parents will grow by $3,000 per child, along with rental and nutritional aid, will cut child poverty by half. Black farmers, indigenous communities, child care centers, and retired union workers on pensions all will get a major and desperately needed infusion of federal dollars. Going big carries risks, said Kevin Williamson in nationalreview.com. So much spending could overheat the economy and spark an inflationary spiral like the one that afflicted our economy in the 1960s and 70s. And while Republican hypocrisy about budget deficits and the national debt has encouraged many Americans to dismiss the issue, the math is the math, irrespective of the GOP's moral standing to thunder about it. A rise in interest rates would boost the interest payments on our staggering debt to levels that would cripple the federal government. What will happen next is the subject of fevered economic debate, said Ben White in Politico.com. If the bill reduces inequality and turbocharges the economy, it could make Biden a hero along the lines of FDR after the Depression or Ronald Reagan in the boomtime 1980s. If gas and home prices surge, speculative assets soar, and inflation fears quell investment, it will be a different story. For Biden, delivering on this pledge will be a moment of glory, but as the nation heads down this new path, a sunny ending is not fully guaranteed. The controversy of the week is titled COVID. Are red states reopening too quickly? Finally, there's a bright light at the end of the tunnel of the COVID-19 pandemic, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. So why are Republican governors recklessly inviting the virus to infect and kill more of their constituents? Governors Greg Abbott of Texas and Tate Reeves of Mississippi both announced last week the lifting of all pandemic restrictions, including limits on bar and restaurant capacity and mask mandates. Texas is open 100%, everything, a giddy Abbott tweeted. The sheer recklessness of the move prompted President Biden to slam the governor's Neanderthal thinking, which in turn triggered a wave of manufactured outrage on the right. The reality is that while infections have dropped from their January peak, there are still more Americans hospitalized than last June. More infectious variants are spreading, and the danger is far from over. By now, Abbott should have learned that lesson, said Jonathan Reiner in CNN.com. Last April, he prematurely allowed non-essential stores to reopen, followed by bars in May, leading to a surge that forced him to ruefully reimpose closures. In October, he opened bars again, and by November, Texas had the most COVID-19 cases in the nation. For Abbott to lift all restrictions now, with his state's test positivity rate three times the national average, shows his utter disregard for the health and safety of 29 million Texans. Not incidentally, a new surge in Texas will spread to other states. Liberals are reacting as if Abbott declared victory over the pandemic, said Noah Rothman in CommentaryMagazine.com. In reality, he told Texans explicitly last week that removing statewide mandates does not end personal responsibility, that masks were still strongly encouraged, and that businesses were free to impose their own restrictions. Texans aren't Neanderthals, said Cynthia Allen in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. Like most Americans, we'll keep erring on the side of caution, but we'll just do it free from government mandates. If only that were true, said Merrill Cornfield in the Washington Post. Abbott and Reeves have put the onus on store and restaurant owners and employees to enforce mask requirements they've kept in place for their own safety. Now there are already reports of people strutting into Texas restaurants and threatening staff who ask them to mask up. Case numbers have dropped nationwide, and Dr. Kavita Patel in MSNBC.com said, Dr. Patel, but that's mainly because mask mandates and other restrictions are actually working. With the end of this nightmare so close, could there be a worse moment to abandon the measures that led to this progress in the first place? Notice how the goalposts have shifted, said Philip Klein in WashingtonExaminer.com. A year ago, the experts said we needed a few weeks of restrictions to flatten the curve and keep hospitals from being overwhelmed. Now they say calamity still awaits unless there are a few more weeks of restrictions. Look, there are legitimate arguments about where and when to open up, said Megan McArdle in the Washington Post. But let's be honest. The red state governors are rushing to lift restrictions only because they've become a political symbol. In Idaho last week, protesters at the state capitol urged kids to throw masks into a fire. As a right-of-center libertarian, I worry that Republicans have become literally reactionary, a party that stands only for opposing whatever the left is doing. This is conservatism in 2021, a perpetual adolescent howl of I'm not gonna, and you can't make me. Here's our good week, bad week piece. Seems it was a good week for Native American remedies. After Susan Rice, head of President Biden's Domestic Policy Council, was reported to be burning sage in her new West Wing office to cleanse it of the bad energy left by its previous occupant, hardline anti-immigration Trump advisor Stephen Miller. It was a good week for following the science after the dating site OkCupid said there's been a 137% increase in the use of the word vaccine among those seeking a companion. And it was a good week for primate solidarity. After four orangutans and five bonobos at the San Diego Zoo received doses of an experimental COVID-19 vaccine for animals. The move comes after all eight of the zoo's gorillas contracted the disease from an infected zookeeper. But it was a bad week for wholesomeness after the Boy Scouts of America began selling off its collection of original paintings by iconic artist Norman Rockwell to help raise $300 million to settle thousands of sexual abuse lawsuits. The 60-plus Rockwells on sale include such titles as The Right Way, On My Honor, and I Will Do My Best. It was a bad week for lost causes after the U.S. Supreme Court rejected without comment the last three of Trump's appeals of his election defeat. And it was a bad week for bipartisanship after Representative Lance Gooden, Republican from Texas, broke with his party to vote for the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, which bans chokeholds along with other reforms. The staunch conservative later explained that I accidentally pressed the wrong voting button and realized it too late. Thank you. We're on the briefing page now with the headline, The COVID Vaccine Pipeline. Pharma firms are racing to produce billions of coronavirus shots. Can they deliver? What's the production target? To fulfill President Biden's goal of having enough COVID-19 vaccine for all 260 million American adults by June, Pfizer and Moderna must each deliver 200 million doses of their two-shot vaccine by that deadline. So far, the federal government has received and distributed about 110 million doses. Johnson & Johnson has pledged to deliver 87 million doses of its one-shot vaccine by the end of May. But shortly before receiving FDA authorization for its shots in late February, J&J revealed it would ship 17 million fewer doses this month than planned. Factories in Kalamazoo, Michigan, Bloomington, Indiana, and Baltimore are producing the new vaccine at a speed that has never been seen before in the history of pharmaceutical manufacturing, and a record 2 million jabs are now being administered in the U.S. each day. But with some 1,700 Americans dying daily of COVID, the vaccine orders pending from foreign countries for billions of doses, pharma firms are under enormous pressure to speed up and overcome production bottlenecks across an incredibly intricate supply chain. The big problem, said Georgetown University Global Health Law Professor Lawrence Gostin, is how do you get a company that is already producing at maximum capacity to go beyond that? How are the vaccines made? The pipeline for Pfizer's innovative shot starts in St. Louis, where bacterial cells embedded with the DNA blueprint for the coronavirus spike protein grow in massive steel vats. After about 4 days, scientists break open the cells and strain out the DNA, which is frozen and shipped, sometimes on Pfizer's company jet or helicopter to Andover, Massachusetts. That DNA is then incubated with genetic building blocks to create messenger RNA, which, when injected into the human body, teaches cells to build replicas of the spike proteins, which in turn teach the immune system to recognize the real thing. Next, frozen mRNA is transported to the 2,000-acre campus in Kalamazoo. There it is used to make the bulk vaccine, which is put in vials, capped, inspected, labeled, and shipped. The mRNA in Moderna's shot is made in Norwood, Massachusetts, and Portsmouth, New Hampshire, then packaged in Bloomington, where five shifts of 2,000 employees keep the assembly line running 24/7. What about Johnson & Johnson? Its vaccine uses a more traditional approach, employing a harmless cold virus to deliver DNA instructions for fighting the coronavirus. The two-month process of fermenting J&J's vaccine is supposed to take place at a Baltimore plant run by a partner firm, Emergent, which received $628 million from the Trump administration to expand production capacity. However, Emergent has still not received FDA approval to make J&J's vaccine. That is expected to happen in the coming weeks. Because of those delays, J&J's first 4 million doses were produced in the Netherlands. The firm is receiving logistical support from the Defense Department and says it is on course to deliver 100 million doses by the summer. This is not making cornflakes, said Sean Kirk, Emergent's executive vice president of manufacturing. It's something that cannot be rushed. Are there enough raw materials? Pfizer and Moderna need more lipids, the fatty nanoparticles that encase their fragile mRNA molecules. The FDA approved lipids as a drug delivery system only 3 years ago, as part of a treatment for genetic disease that affects some 50,000 people worldwide. Unsurprisingly, the pharma industry was in no way prepared to suddenly supply nanoparticles for billions of COVID shots. Pfizer and Moderna are sourcing the material from the few companies in the U.S. and Europe that produce lipids and are helping those firms scale up the complex manufacturing process. Both the Trump and Biden administrations invoked the Defense Production Act to give Pfizer and Moderna priority for lipids, and also used the Korean War era law to address a shortage of glass vials needed to hold the finished vaccines. What else is the federal government doing? The Biden administration has helped factories secure much-needed machinery, tubing, and filtration systems. Officials have also secured the country for additional manufacturing capacity, and last week brokered a historical deal under which the government will pay pharma giant Merck $269 million to devote two of its facilities to producing Johnson & Johnson's vaccine. This is the type of collaboration between companies we saw in World War II, said Biden. One Merck location will ferment the vaccine, potentially doubling supply, and the other will provide fill-finish services. Setting up those facilities will take several months, but could aid with the production of booster shots that might be needed to tackle variants later this year. Are other firms collaborating? Yes, but it's not as simple as giving a recipe to another restaurant, said John Grabenstein of the Immunization Action Coalition. That recipe is thousands of pages long. Each facility that works on a component of a vaccine needs regulatory approval to perform that specific function. Despite these hurdles, Pfizer has struck deals with 10 partners worldwide, including French giant Sanofi and Swiss firm Novartis. Sanofi will also help J&J fill vials in Europe. Those working day and night at vaccine factories know the importance of their work. It's a dream project, said Chaz Kalitri, who leads the vaccine program of Pfizer's Kalamazoo plant. But at the same time, it's the weight of the world. Read a few of the best columns, starting with one from David French at thedispatch.com. Persuading the vaccine hesitant. The good news is that vaccine hesitancy is going down, said David French. A new Pew Research Center poll finds that 69% of Americans say they've either already received the COVID vaccine or will probably get it in the future. The bad news is that vaccine hesitancy breaks down sharply along partisan and religious lines, and that hesitancy is so profound in white evangelical communities that it could disrupt the quest for herd immunity. Only 54% of my fellow evangelicals say they're likely to be vaccinated. This hesitancy reflects both an information problem and a spiritual problem. Evangelicals largely distrust science and government agencies, and many think it's proof of their faith that God will protect them when they refuse to wear a mask or get vaccinated. Rather than mock them for these views, it would be far more effective to have fellow Christians respectfully address their fears and to explain why they personally decided to get vaccinated. We need to explain why it's actually a Christian responsibility to make sacrifices like mask wearing and vaccination for the good of others. Indeed, every Christian should take a shot not just for ourselves, but also for our friends, our family, and the country we love. The GOP's hypocrisy on Chow. If you're upset that Hunter Biden tried to do business in China, said Helene Olin, Elaine Chao should send you into fits of rage. Last week, a blistering Inspector General's report detailed how President Trump's Treasury Secretary repeatedly used her subordinates to help her family's shipping business dealings with China. Chao, whose husband is Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, told federal workers to develop a media strategy and public relations plan for her father, James, who founded Foremost Group, a shipping conglomerate. In 2017, DOT ethics lawyers raised red flags when Chow invited her father and her sister Angela, who now runs Foremost, to her meetings with Chinese government officials. In 2018, Chow, whose $20 million net worth largely comes from family connections, helped her father do interviews with the Chinese press, and again tried to bring family members to her meetings with Chinese officials. The Inspector General's office referred a report on her activities to Trump's Justice Department, which declined to investigate, even as Trump and Republicans were hysterically criticizing Hunter Biden's business activities in China. How's that for hypocrisy? And this is an international column from Japan. Can it move past Fukushima's toxic legacy? It's been 10 years since a tsunami swamped the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant on Japan's eastern Pacific coast, causing three of its six reactors to melt down. The cleanup is still ongoing, said the Yomiuri Shimbun in an editorial, and is expected to take 30 to 40 years to complete. Nearly 1.25 million tons of dangerously radioactive cooling water and groundwater seepage is being stored at the site in 100 massive metal tanks. It will have to be decontaminated before being dumped into the ocean. And the removal of 900 tons of molten fuel debris from the reactors has yet to begin because the cores are still too hot. Before the disaster, we had 54 nuclear reactors that produced about a third of Japan's energy. All were shuttered for safety inspections after the tsunami, and only nine have restarted, leaving us painfully dependent on imported oil. Japan will need more reactors online if we're to hit our goal of zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. Yet about 39% of voters want all nuclear plants closed. The government has a long way to go to address the deep-rooted distrust and anxiety among the public over nuclear power. Many Japanese are putting their hopes in renewable energy, said Eric Johnson in the Japan Times. Soon after the accident, the government of Prime Minister Naoto Kan pushed through a law that guarantees above-market rates for wind, solar, and geothermal energy, making the sector more attractive to investors. Renewables now provide 18% of Japan's generated electricity, roughly double the amount in 2011. Increasing that share is a challenge because the power grids owned by major electricity producers say they can't accept all the energy generated by renewables, arguing that would cause supply instability in adverse weather conditions. Green energy advocates suspect that's an excuse offered by the utilities to cut competition with their own thermal and nuclear power plants. Japan needn't fear nuclear energy, said Doug Saunders in the Globe and Mail from Canada. Fukushima was the worst-case scenario in which the worst possible reactor built in the worst possible place and operated by perhaps the least competent people was exposed to the worst possible seismic event. Yet while the 2011 tsunami killed some 20,000 people, no one died of radiation poisoning, and cancer rates have not risen in the Fukushima region. The real and encouraging lesson is that a nuclear meltdown need not be a catastrophe. The tsunami wasn't the real culprit, said nuclear safety experts. Fukushima's meltdown was the result of an ineffective safety culture at the utility TEPCO, which managed the plant, and lax regulatory oversight by the government. Contrast Fukushima with the Onagawa nuclear plant just 39 miles away. It was hit even harder by the tsunami, but the plant shutdown was flawless because it was run by a different utility with a proactive safety culture. Nuclear power can avoid future failures, but only with tough safety standards and tough independent regulation. The title of our Last Word article is The Broken Families of QAnon. On a Reddit forum, tens of thousands of Americans look for support as their family members disappear down the conspiracy theory rabbit hole, said Greg Jaffe and Jose Del Real in the Washington Post. She brought ammunition, camping gear, a water purifier, and boxes of canned food. Then Tyler's mother started wearing a holstered pistol around the house, convinced that 10 days of unrest and mass power outages were coming. The chaos will culminate, she assured her son, in former President Donald Trump's triumphant return to power on March 4th. The original inauguration day before the passage of the 20th Amendment in 1932. Tyler, 24, had been living with his mother an hour north of Minneapolis since he graduated from college in 2019. The paranoia and fear that had engulfed his home had become unbearable in the months since Trump began to falsely acclaim that the 2020 election had been stolen from him. Any advice for dealing with a QAnon parent who thinks WW3 will happen during the inauguration? Tyler asked last month on r/QAnon casualties, a fast-growing Reddit group for those whose loved ones have been consumed by the bizarre and Byzantine universe of baseless conspiracy theories known as QAnon. Do they have weapons? One of the site's moderators asked. Yep, a lot of them, Tyler replied. I would leave, but I don't have anywhere to go. He said he couldn't imagine cutting ties to his mother. In Washington, rioters, inflamed by unfounded allegations of a stolen election, had stormed the Capitol, leaving 5 dead and triggering the impeachment of a president. Far from Washington, the falsehoods that had whipped so many into a frenzy were wreaking a different sort of chaos, one that was tearing families apart. The anguish was playing out behind closed doors in therapist offices, where overwhelmed family members were seeking advice. And it was painfully clear on QAnon Casualties, the Reddit group where Tyler had turned for support. The group offered a rough barometer of the growing turmoil. Since last summer, it had grown from about 10,000 members to more than 130,000 in the days after Joe Biden's inauguration. Each day, there was a flood of new posts. A woman in Chattanooga, Tennessee, was just days away from moving out of the house she and her partner bought 5 years earlier. I feel like I'm in a twisted Black Mirror episode that's lasting way too long, she wrote. I feel hopeless that we will ever get back to the beautiful life we shared in our lovely home. A woman in Palm Beach, Florida, had gone 2 weeks without speaking to her mother and was starting to wonder if the rift was irreparable. I grieve for her every day as if she's dead, she wrote. A teenager in Annapolis, Maryland, worried that she no longer knew her father. I've come to the breaking point, she confessed. My heart goes out to everyone else in this situation. It really sucks. An atmosphere of fear pervaded Tyler's home. To protect his family's anonymity, the Washington Post is only using Tyler's first name. Sometimes it felt as if every conversation with his mom and her new husband circled back to Trump-related conspiracies. Alone in his bedroom, Tyler read many of the new posts on Reddit, hoping that they would help him make sense of his mother's beliefs. The first QAnon casualties post went up on July 4th, 2019, some 2 years after the conspiracy's unidentified online originator, known as Q, baselessly claimed that Trump was secretly leading a war against an elite cabal of pedophiles who controlled Washington, Hollywood, and the world. By that point, QAnon was no longer just an online phenomenon in which the group's most fanatical adherents called for hanging traitors and waiting for the storm, an awakening that would reveal the true breadth of evil in America. Some followers had begun showing up at Trump rallies wearing T-shirts and holding signs advertising their cause. My mom has been into QAnon since it got started, wrote the QAnon Casualties founder, who has since deactivated his Reddit account. The ignorance, bigotry, and refusal to question the plan has only gotten worse over time. I'm always torn between stopping communication with her because it only seems to make me feel terrible and feeling like it's my responsibility to lead her back to reality. The founder described his experience with his mother as exhausting, sad, scary, demoralizing, and invited members to vent or share coping strategies. Other Reddit groups, such as cult_headquarters, were dedicated to discrediting and mocking the growing conspiracy. QAnon Casualties, the group's founder wrote, was intended to be a comforting place. Thank the blanking stars I found you guys, replied one of the first to join. Today has been hard. My mother is a hardcore believer, wrote another. I found her Twitter account handle, and I'm horrified and embarrassed. Who is this person? Like many conspiracy theories, QAnon supplied a good versus evil narrative into which complicated world events could be easily incorporated. Especially during the pandemic, Q provided a structure to explain what was going on, said Mike Rothschild, author of The Storm is Upon Us, which documents QAnon's rise. A big part of what made it novel was that it was interactive, allowing its followers to take part in the hunt for clues as if they were playing a video game. Social media algorithms, built to capture and keep consumers' attention, helped expand the pool of hardcore believers by leading curious individuals to online groups of believers and feeding them fresh QAnon conspiracy theories. Unlike other online conspiracy theories, it also had the blessing of some top Republicans, such as Trump, who embraced the movement in hope that he could channel believers' rabid and sometimes violent passions for political gain. It's a bet that they can control this insurgency and use it to defeat their opposition and retain control, said Lawrence Rosenthal, chair of the Berkeley Center for Right-Wing Studies. The bet is that we can ride this tiger. And sometimes, as in Germany and Italy, you can get eaten by the tiger. The same news events that inflamed QAnon followers' passions often produced simultaneously big spikes in QAnon casualties' membership rolls. On the day the news media declared Biden the winner of the 2020 election, the online support group added 2,500 new members, according to Reddit. More than 6,000 joined in the days after the Capitol riots, and another 7,300 people signed up in the hours after Biden was inaugurated. Some family members who flocked to the site wondered if they were partially to blame for their loved one's descent into madness. I know that disengaging with my sister as our beliefs began to diverge is why she turned to Q in the first place, a 33-year-old woman from Maryland wrote on QAnon Casualties. Still, I will just never understand. Others sought out advice and coping strategies. How should I handle my relationship with my dad after I leave home? Asked an 18-year-old from Tampa, whose father believed that Bill Gates and other globalists were going to use the coronavirus vaccine to implant microchips in unsuspecting Americans. I still love the man, and part of the reason this has me so torn up is that I feel I may lose him for good. The tens of thousands flocking to QAnon Casualties represented only a subset of the pain sweeping the country. A recent NPR Ipsos poll found that 17% of adults believe that a group of Satan-worshipping elites who run a child sex ring are trying to control our politics and media. Some psychologists liken the spread of QAnon to a global pandemic. I've been practicing for 30 years, and this feels very different, said Nancy Molitor, a clinical psychologist in Chicago and assistant professor at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. There have always been cults, but this one is a doozy. On QAnon Casualties, family members worried that mental health counselors might dismiss their fears or conclude that they had lost touch with reality. I am now going to my first therapy appointment to deal with this, and I have no idea how to talk to my therapist without sounding like I'm completely crazy. A middle school teacher from Wichita wrote in early February after cutting off contact with her mother. Has anyone else gone to therapy for this? I'm so brokenhearted because I currently have no blood relatives that I can speak to. I'm so tired. After the Capitol riots, Tyler began spending more and more time messaging with people he had met on QAnon casualties. He graduated from a local university in 2019 with a degree in manufacturing engineering. In early January, he quit his job with a local manufacturer, hoping to find something that required a college degree. He was living at home. Without a way to vent, I would be truly alone on this, and it would break me over time, he wrote on QAnon Casualties Discussion Group. A few days after the Capitol riots, one of his mother's oldest friends stopped by to deliver a wedding present. Tyler's mother had recently remarried. Do you plan on shooting someone today? The friend said. She joked when she noticed Tyler's mom was wearing a pistol. You never know what's going to happen with the Democrats, Tyler's mother replied, according to the friend, who spoke on condition of anonymity. They stole the election. We're not going to do anything, replied the friend who voted for Biden. The argument continued to escalate, and the friend said she left. She described Tyler's mother as normally a wonderful person who accompanied her on kayaking trips and invited her over for tea. But she was stunned by the response. We're 50 miles north of Minneapolis, she said. She was concerned for everybody, but in the Republican way. I don't know how to explain it. Tyler held out hope that Biden's inauguration on January 20th might help ease tensions in the House. It seems like my mom is returning to her old self, he wrote on January 21. I mean, she's still political, but now it's not in my face 24/7. I'll take that any day. The respite, though, didn't last. Soon she was insisting that Trump would return to the White House in early March. Tyler said he decided to confront her. I told my mom everything, he texted his father's wife, Heather, on the morning of February 3rd. Tyler's father had lost contact with him when his son was a child, and they had only reconnected in recent years. Told her what? Heather asked. That I don't believe in Trump or any of her theories, Tyler replied. He said his mother had threatened to have her new husband hurt him when he returned home from work. Tyler wasn't actually worried for his safety. I've been dealing with this for years, he texted. It's normal for me. That's not love, Heather replied. Tyler wrote back asking if he could stay at his stepmother and father's house until his mother cooled off. When Heather pulled up to the house 30 minutes later, Tyler was standing in the front yard holding an overnight bag. He climbed into the car, exhaled, and closed his eyes. Heather, a registered nurse, said she put her hand on Tyler's shoulder and began to cry. These days, Tyler is living in his 7-year-old half-sister's bedroom while she sleeps in her parents' room. Recently, his mother's new husband told him that he was no longer welcome at their home. When your daddy gets sick of you living there, and he will, don't bother calling us, he wrote. Tyler said he still hopes that the rancor and conspiracy theories fueled by the Trump presidency will fade. Maybe then, he said, he'll be able to rebuild a relationship with his mother. About a week after he moved out, he drove by his mother's home to pick up his belongings. His mother was inside. His things had recently been placed on the front lawn and were covered in a light dusting of snow. I just don't see the humanity in this, he said. I wanted my family back, not this hatred. A version of this story originally appeared in the Washington Post. Here's an obituary for you. The activist who became a D.C. power broker. Vernon Jordan, 1935 to 2021. Vernon Jordan never held an elected office or cabinet position, but for years he was one of Washington's top power brokers, commanding the ear of presidents and congressional leaders and wielding an influence that reached from Beltway law firms to black churches and blue-chip boardrooms. A towering figure with prodigious charm, he spent his early career in the civil rights movement, serving as president of the advocacy group National Urban League. He hit the peak of his D.C. power under President Bill Clinton as the commander-in-chief's first friend and close advisor. In later years, he was named an executive at the investment firm Lazard Frères and sat on numerous corporate boards where he promoted black advancement. Black power will remain just a shout and a cry, he said in 1971, unless it is channeled into constructive effort to influence the established institutions of American politics. Jordan was born in Atlanta, where his father worked as a postman. He spent his childhood in public housing, but was exposed to the city's elite through his mother, who worked as a caterer for many of the city's affluent citizens. Prodded by his mother, he went north for college, studying political science at Indiana's DePaul University, where he was one of the five black students. After earning a law degree at Howard University, he worked on desegregation and voter registration efforts in southern states, and led the United Negro College Fund for a year. From 1971 to 1981, he headed the Urban League, a high-profile position that made him a target for white supremacists. He almost died in 1980 when he was shot in the back by a racist outside a hotel in Indiana. His connection to Clinton, whom he had befriended in the 1970s, entangled Jordan in the Monica Lewinsky scandal, said the New York Times. He was investigated for possibly assisting Clinton in covering up the affair and testified five times before a grand jury and House impeachment committee, but no action was taken against him. After Clinton left the White House, Jordan went on to serve on more than a dozen corporate and nonprofit boards, mentoring the next generation of black executives. My view on all this business about race is never to get angry, no, but to get even, he said in 2000. You don't take it out in anger, you take it out in achievement. And we'll go right into a couple of short articles on the health and science page, starting with scientists talk with lucid dreamers. In the Hollywood blockbuster Inception, Leonardo DiCaprio plays a thief who sneaks into people's dreams and interacts with the sleepers so he can steal secrets from their subconscious. That science fiction story is now slightly closer to reality after scientists successfully spoke with people in their dreams, and the dreamers spoke back. Researchers have long known that when people are lucid dreaming, a relatively uncommon state in which sleepers are aware that they are dreaming, they can communicate out from their dreams by moving their eyes or twitching their face. Karen Conkley from Northwestern University wondered if it was also possible to communicate in and ask sleepers questions that they could hear in their dreams. Conkley and her colleagues trained 36 lucid dreamers to communicate answers while asleep. Asked what is 8 minus 6, for example, they would give the answer 2 by twice moving their eyes to the left, then to the right. Over 158 trials, the participants gave a correct answer 18% of the time and the wrong answer only 3%. The rest of the time, sleepers didn't answer or it was unclear whether they were responding. Interestingly, some dreamers said the questions posed by the researchers melded into the content of their dreams. One participant, said Conkley, heard the questions as though it was God talking. Fears over the weakening Gulf Stream. A crucial system of currents in the Atlantic Ocean is at its weakest level in over a millennium, oceanographers have warned, and climate change is likely responsible. If the trend continues, it could trigger a potentially devastating series of consequences, including faster sea level rise on the U.S. East Coast, more heat waves and harsher winters in Europe, and reduced rainfall in Africa. The system, the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, AMOC, includes the Gulf Stream, which pushes warm surface water from the Gulf of Mexico toward the North Atlantic. Previous studies indicated that the AMOC has weakened by about 15% since 1950, and that new research appears to confirm these findings. Of particular concern is a cold blob of water south of Greenland, which may be a result of runoff from the melting ice sheet and which seems to be causing warm water to linger off the coast of the northeastern U.S. The doomsday scenario is that the AMOC will collapse completely, upending global climate systems. Researchers say that's unlikely, but possible. The consequences of this are so massive, said co-author Stefan Ramsdorf from Germany's Potsdam Institute, that even a 10% chance of triggering a breakdown would be an unacceptable risk. And moving on to the Talking Points page, we have Dr. Seuss scrubbing his canon of racist stereotypes. Oh, the extreme places they'll go, said Robbie Suave in Reason.com. The company behind Dr. Seuss' estate caved to the concessions left last week and said it will stop publishing six of Seuss's lesser-known children's books from early in his career because they contain hurtful racial stereotypes, including a bright yellow Japanese man in The Cat's Quizzer, two Africans drawn as monkeys in If I Ran the Zoo, and slant-eyed Asians with conical hats who eat with sticks in Seuss's first book, And to Think I Saw It on Mulberry Street. Public libraries in Chicago and several other communities yanked the six books from their shelves, and eBay delisted them. But in reaction to Fox News' proclamation that all of Seuss was being canceled, consumers sent dozens of his other books to the top Amazon charts. Seuss's racist caricatures are obviously offensive, said Kevin Williamson in the New York Post. As it turns out, a man born in 1904 and writing during the Roosevelt administration did not have a racial sensibility or conception of etiquette identical with our own today. But kids can handle serious and sometimes troubling themes in children's literature, and for neurotic adults to censor a flawed genius like Seuss rather than put his work into historical context is an act of intellectual and cultural violence. Nonsense, said Lily Wilkinson in The Guardian. We make changes to the books our children read all the time. Few parents would give their kids dated classics like Little Black Sambo, and even authors see the need to right their wrongs, such as when Roald Dahl replaced the dark-skinned African pygmies in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory with orange Oompa Loompas. Theodore Seuss Geisel, who died in 1991, also evolved beyond his early racism, and for his foundation to decide to stop publishing these early works is not cancel culture, and it's not censorship. It's a commercial decision to protect an author's legacy in a new era. Might Seuss have withdrawn these books if he were alive today? Asked Jack Schaefer in Politico.com. Maybe. He was a solid man of the left from the 1940s until his death, with his books brimming with progressive messages. The Sneetches mock the absurdity of racism in class, while Horton Hears a Who contains the famous line, "A person's a person, no matter how small." The Lorax, published in 1971, overflows with its right think about peace, brotherhood, and environmentalism. The vast, vast majority of Seuss's 60-something books will still be sold, said Philip Bump in WashingtonPost.com. So why the pained protest about cancel culture and political correctness over six books that barely anyone reads anymore? Simple. Conservative white people see criticism of the casual racism of the past as criticism of their own behavior and as a threatening reminder of how the world around them is changing. The old casual racism did real change, said Charles Blow in the New York Times. As a black child, I was immersed in TV shows, cartoons, toys, and children books that were filled with demeaning racist stereotypes. In The Little Rascals, the buckwheat character was drawn from the stereotype of a great grinning pickaninny. Tarzan outwitted the primitive natives. Speedy Gonzales made a mockery of Mexicans. TV westerns depicted Native Americans as bloodthirsty savages. Popular culture taught me that everything white was right, good, noble, and beautiful. White people of color were comically stupid, ugly, or inferior. Racism must be exercised from culture, and what better place to start than with literature that shapes children's minds? And that leaves us about with time for a quote. This comes from essayist Charles Dudley Warner, quoted in the Paducah, Kentucky Sun, who says, "Everybody talks about the weather, but nobody does anything about it." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have questions or comments, please give us a call. The number is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.